While he was still speaking, a crowd came up, and the man who was called Judas, one of the 12, was leading them. He approached Jesus to kiss him, but Jesus asked him, "Judas, are you betraying the Son of Man with a kiss?" When Jesus' followers saw what was going to happen, they said, "Lord, should we strike with our swords?" And one of them struck the servant of the high priest, cutting off his right ear. But Jesus answered, "No more of this." And he touched the man's ear and healed him. Then Jesus said to the chief priests, the officers of the temple guard, and the elders who had come for him, "Am I leading a rebellion that you have come with swords and clubs? Every day I was with you in the temple courts, and you did not lay a hand on me. But this is your hour when darkness reigns."
It's good to see everyone here today. I know a lot of people have been visiting family and friends during the holidays. We've been traveling around. Looks like most folks are back home now. You know, school's about to start up again. Back to the norm. I do want to let you know that if you weren't here last week, I have some bad news for you. You missed a Sunday with no sermon. So sorry. You could have gotten attendance points with no sermon. I mean, that's tough. Sorry about that. The worst part of it is, though, you didn't get to hear the four Northlake brothers and sisters who shared their reflections with us on where they sense God leading this church in the future, into the future. The good news is you can go on our website and listen to that this week and catch up. Maybe you'll get points for that anyway if you did. Please do go online, listen to their reflections from last week. They were rich, wonderful reflections. Kathy Rice, Joe Glenn, Denise Johnson, Patrick Bradshaw all shared with us. So you're going to want to listen to that. And then we encouraged everyone to pray and to reflect and to write down their own reflections as well. How is God leading you at this time in your life? Where do you see God leading this church into the future? Those are important things, and that's something that we build and discern together. I'm beginning today a series of sermons that will take us up to Easter, and this series of sermons is on the gospel stories of Jesus' passion, the events that lead up to the cross. And I was trying to think how to structure this series, and as I did, I was kept thinking back to the one visit that I've gotten to make to Jerusalem in my life, and it was a number of years ago, and I remember in Jerusalem being on the street called the Via Dolorosa. And the Via Dolorosa, or the Way of Suffering, is the way that translates. It's one of the oldest streets there in the city. And some people think that it's the route taken by Jesus as he carried the cross. Of course, those true ancient streets 2,000 years ago were probably 15 or 20 feet under that level of the city. But that street does lead to the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, which I would think most would think that that is the actual site of Jesus' crucifixion and burial. So it seems an appropriate route to take there. And all along that street, if you're visiting Jerusalem, you'll see groups of pilgrims walking together down the street, and many of the groups carrying a cross, and they will be stopping along the way. It's specific spots to read scripture, to reflect, to pray along those places. You know, Christians have been going to Jerusalem since the 4th century on pilgrimage. And when those ancient pilgrims went home, they wanted to carry some of that experience with them, and they wanted to share it with other people. So over the centuries, they developed a practice called the Stations of the Cross, or the Way of the Cross. It's called both things. Usually this consisted of just a series of images that captured events along the way to the cross for Jesus, and those would be arranged along a path, or perhaps around a church building in stained glass, and people could go from glass or station to station along the way and read and think about that event, or reflect on that event and pray and recite prayers there. The object of that, you know, as you think about it, it was not just to remember those events. Remembering was a big part of that, not just the event itself, but it was a way of experiencing Christ's journey to the cross as well. It was both recognizing it as a real event in history and as a journey that we're called to make as well, trying to both remember Jesus as he went to the cross and reflect on what it means to go to the cross with him, to carry our own cross, as Jesus said that we must. And I thought, you know, as I reflected on it, that's the kind of experience I need in my own life, I would like for us to have together. I need something that draws me into this story personally. So I've selected 12 stations or ways along the way to the cross for this series. And I hope that as we go, we reflect on each one as part of our own journey of faith. The first scene is the one David read to us so beautifully, the scene in the Garden of Gethsemane. And that it's a garden is something that we know from the Gospel of John. John calls it a garden. Matthew and Mark call it Gethsemane. Luke calls it the place on the Mount of Olives. And so one of the things that I want you to recognize as we go through this series is that often there are different kind of versions of this between the four Gospels. They have different viewpoints on these events. This way of reading the Gospels is different from the way we've been doing it as well, as we've studied the Gospels. Typically, I've been going from Advent to Easter and just picking one Gospel and kind of going right through that Gospel and just taking that one viewpoint. But in this series, you know, you're going to have to need to think about, you know, all of the different ways that the different Gospels reflect on this. We have this tendency, and anybody who's listened to many Bible school teachers, Sunday school classes growing up, or preachers, we have this tendency to synthesize all of these different stories into one story in our mind. And it's hard to peel out those things, to pull out those strands. But each gospel has its own distinct way of telling this story. Matthew, Mark, and Luke are more similar to each other. These three appear to be using the same witnesses and the same source material. The Gospel of John has the most unique view on these things. And so we need to pay attention to both the similarities and to the differences. And it shouldn't bother us that there are differences here. A policeman doesn't discount the testimony of a witness to a 10-car pileup because somebody else in that event saw it a different way. People see things different ways. People have different viewpoints. Eyewitnesses even have different viewpoints, and they're all valid and can be valid. None of the four gospel writers makes the claim that God whispers these words somehow in their ear. Luke gives us probably the best window on his writing process anyway in the very first verses of his book. He says, "Many have undertaken to draw up an account of the things that have been fulfilled among us." Many have undertaken to draw up an account. "Just as they were handed down to us by those who were from the first were eyewitnesses and servants of the word." With this in mind, since I myself have carefully investigated everything from the beginning, I too decided to write an orderly account for you, so that you may know the certainty of the things that you've been taught. So you see, he's got a particular way he's going about this here. It seems that God decided, whether we like it or not, that one primary stream feeding the flow of faith that we have in our life is going to come from the tributary of human testimony, and that it's an important stream in this. As Jesus said to Thomas after the resurrection, "Because you've seen me, you've believed. Blessed are those who've not seen and yet have believed." And that's a word for us. We've not seen, but yet we believe. And that was part of God's plan all along. One way God works is through the variety of human testimony. So we need to pay attention to each gospel's unique perspective. Try to understand what each individually is saying. Pay attention to the unique truth that each one offers. And then bring them together and reflect on how they're alike and how they're different. And search for those ways to harmonize, perhaps, and to discover overarching truths that are there. And we can be honest about those places that don't seem to harmonize. There's truth to be learned there as well. Particularly, that's a place to notice. So this first way to read the Gospels is not to try to chisel off, you know, the bumpy places, sand them all down so that they're all uniform, but to read them and appreciate them in their uniqueness and to accept the differences within them. And then contemplate that. Contemplate all of that and contemplate the differences there and the mystery of one who is fully human, fully divine, and opens God's life to us. I think that the fact that there are different views of the same events here is a blessing for us. The Spirit of God working in the lives of these writers led them not to overly harmonize their own accounts and led the church to preserve each gospel with all of their differences. The reason I think that there are differences here, or at least one of the reasons, besides their own unique perspectives, but to think about it from another standpoint, is that they're testifying to something that is beyond a two-dimensional reality. This goes beyond words on a page. It's beyond a three-dimensional reality, just a physical life. There's a fourth dimension that we perceive here as believers in this. There are unseen factors at work. We believe God's hand is in this. And we believe then that there is some level of understanding of these things that would only be accessible to us by the Spirit of God. So shouldn't we expect some degree of mystery? Some things that are unexplainable for us in all of this, where human perception meets eternal reality. In the garden, Matthew and Mark say that Jesus went back and forth three times asking Peter, James, and John to stay awake and pray. Luke says that he told all of his disciples one time. Now, those things, I think, can fit together without much difficulty. But when Luke says that Jesus knelt on the ground, and then Matthew says that Jesus fell with his face to the ground, that sounds a little more like a stark contrast here. Or compare that with the Gospel of John, which skips all of the interaction with the disciples and shows us a Jesus who is completely in control and tranquil and calm through this whole event. And then you compare that with Mark. And Mark says, "He began to be deeply distressed and troubled and said, 'My soul is overwhelmed with sorrow to the point of death.'" So there are differences here. Those are things to be observed. Pay attention to them. Don't try to harmonize all of those things. Enjoy them. Be blessed by them. Let those things minister to us as they are. So Matthew, Mark, and Luke, to a somewhat lesser degree, show us a Jesus who is struggling emotionally here, like any human being would. Jesus asks for some other way. Take this cup from me. He doesn't want to die. He's not a masochist. He values life. And what does that say to us when even Jesus wants his friends to stay close and he's troubled, when he needs his friends close by him? What does that say about us when we're troubled and we're in need? John, on the other hand, emphasizes that Jesus, again, he's just in control of all of this that's happening to him. John compares Jesus to a lamb in the gospel. And in one sense, Jesus goes to the cross as a lamb to the slaughter, but then there's another sense that a lamb doesn't know what's about to happen. Jesus fully knows what's about to happen to him, and he goes anyway. And all of the Gospels show us that Jesus goes to the garden with some awareness that Judas is going to show up there, that he is going to be found there, that this is going to be a place, the crossroads, at which his enemies will begin to move. And Jesus doesn't try to hide in the garden. Jesus asks his followers in the garden to pray and not to sleep. To pray and not to sleep. I've been reading a book that I got for a Christmas present this year on the science of sleep. And did you know that every living thing sleeps? Even little one-celled organisms that they study show that when darkness falls, they sleep. They start to shut down and then wake up with light. Possums sleep 17 hours a day, by the way. Did you know that? Dolphins only sleep with half of their brain at a time. I could go on with this. Don't get me started on birds. There's some fascinating things about them. My kids have been rolling their eyes all Christmas time long. Don't read any more of that book to us. But the way the book tells it, sleep is a good thing. Sleep is a very good thing, something that we as organisms, living things, need. The disciples believe they need sleep. They had a late dinner, stress of the whole week, it all adds up. Science would say if they're going to function at their best, they need to get some shut-eye. Jesus says, or Luke says, when Jesus rose from prayer and went back to the disciples, he found them asleep, exhausted from sorrow. And he asked them, "Why are you sleeping? Get up and pray that you'll not fall into temptation." So if it's prayer versus sleep for you, which one normally wins out? And how does staying awake help with temptation? I don't know about you, but I'm least likely to sin when I'm unconscious. It's my best time. It's my best time. Why did Jesus tell them to do something no one can do? Stay awake all the time. We all give in to sleep. If people don't sleep, they die. Sleep is a function of our limitation as human beings. You also probably remember that in the Gospels, especially in Matthew and John, sleep is more than just the physical act of going unconscious every night for a few hours. Remember Jesus' story. When does the enemy come and sow the weeds among the wheat? While the servants sleep, right? When Jesus' followers want to know the schedule for when God's going to come and stop all the carnage and rearrange the world like it's supposed to be, they want to get it down on their day planners so we'll know when this event is coming. Jesus says to them, keep awake. You don't know what day your Lord is coming. If the owner of the house had known at what time of night the thief was coming, he would have kept watch and wouldn't let his house be broken into. So you must also be ready, because the Son of Man is going to come at an hour when you don't expect him. Or especially I think about the parable of the 10 bridesmaids. When the bridegroom was late All of them became drowsy and slept. But five of them had anticipated that this might happen, so they'd gotten themselves some extra oil. The other five went to sleep thinking, well, I'll take care of it tomorrow. And where did they find themselves? Out in the darkness. What does prayer do that sleep can't? Jesus himself in the garden prays, as he told his disciples to pray. And Jesus says, Father, if you're willing, take this cup from me. Did you anticipate that? It's so hard to read these for the first time, isn't it? And to think about what it would have been like to read this for the first time. Take this cup from me. Did you anticipate that? Did you anticipate he would come to this moment and make this request? Yet, not my will, but yours be done. Now, Jesus all along seemed to know what was going to happen in the garden. Why ask for something from God when it seems God has shown you the way you've got to go? Well, if it's your boss telling you, or if it's the state trooper telling you this is the way things have got to be, maybe you don't ask again. But if it's your father, if it's this parent who loves you, doesn't a loved child know that a loving parent wants to hear the deepest things on their heart? And doesn't that child trust that loving parent finally to know what's best to do? And so Jesus in prayer gives himself up here not to an unconscious state like sleep, but to a higher consciousness, to the will of the one that he called Father. Jesus went to the cross because he had decided, not that he wanted the cross, but because he decided he wanted the Father. He wanted God. He wanted to obey God. The cross wasn't something that he deserved. He endured that trial that he would go through willingly. And all through this, he continues to love. Some of the last words on his lips will be words of forgiveness. His last miracle, the one David read when he reaches out and touches the ear of one who would be his enemy. That was the course that he chose. And notice also that this prayer that Jesus prays in the garden is the same one that he taught us to pray. Our Father in heaven, holy is your name, your kingdom come, your will be done. If we choose to follow Jesus, we choose to do things his way. Apparently, the disciples hadn't prayed enough. So they weren't prepared when that mob came with swords and clubs and torches. Well, they ask Jesus what to do, but lash out before he can answer. How often we pray and then do things our way anyway. There's a great conflict in this world. Darkness seems to have hold on it. And it takes much faith to believe that the light is going to overcome that darkness. It may look at times as if everything is lost. We're going to be tempted to choose to act along with the darkness. But those who choose to follow Jesus must continue to pray, not my will, yours be done. And then we must live it. And we've got to stay awake to the stark reality of our world. And we're probably going to nod off from time to time, like those sleepy bridesmaids did. But success, thankfully, is not based on our own perfection. We have one who is even now and always interceding for us, praying words that we can't pray. He will not sleep. He is at the Father's right hand forever. That does not mean that he is separate and inaccessible to us in any sense. But with his life, he is now bringing together heaven and earth for us, in us, and will, he says, until the end of the age. Those are the promises for us as believers. As we go through this series, I pray that we can all stop and think each week as we go along this way of the cross. Observe this image, Jesus in the garden, his disciples sleepy, needing to pray. That's us. How are we in this story? How are you in this story today? May God be with us as we take up our own cross and follow him. Let's stand.